Gun violence in Illinois cities tends to jump in the summer months. Former U.S. Attorney Jim Lewis says many communities are changing their approach to confronting the violence.
Instead of just being law enforcement cleaning up after the damage is done, you decide to talk to the people directly.
That kind of prevention is one key element of Rockford's Strong Neighborhood Houses program. We'll hear more about what the community there is doing to stop the gun violence. Plus,
over the course of a day in this country, there's almost 29,000 people a day that are abused by someone they know, love, and trust.
Carol Myrna with the Center for Prevention of Abuse in Peoria. Corporate lawyers in the Chicagoland area are now stepping up to fill a growing need. Free legal assistance to victims of domestic violence. And how do courts consider race and ethnicity when it comes to juries for trials? We talk about a new ruling in Iowa and what it could mean for Illinois. That's all coming up on this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Conversations about gun violence in Illinois tend to focus on Chicago, especially in the national media. But gun violence, as we've heard on the show, is a growing problem all across the state. In the summer, we've been talking with people in many of those communities to learn about what's driving the problem and some of the innovative things they're doing to try and stop the gun violence. Today, we turn to the Rockford area, northern Illinois. In just a moment, we'll be joined by two community leaders there working to help address the problem. But first, I'm joined by Grant Schubert. He's a neighborhood impact manager with the United Way of Rock River Valley, working in the Midtown neighborhood. Grant, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I appreciate you taking the time here. So you're doing work right there in the community. You're on the ground. You're listening and working with folks. You know, for those of us, let's start, who aren't familiar with Rockford, you know, what can you tell us about the neighborhood there where you're working?
So the Midtown area is what the United Way a couple years ago deemed a high priority neighborhood, a neighborhood that we know we need to work on as a community that's going to kind of lift the community up as a whole. So you're looking at, you know, a high crime in some of these pockets, blighted houses, and, you know, higher unemployment than in other pockets of the city. So what we really want to do is try to bring up these neighborhoods that we continue to see on these, you know, lists that are kind of, you know, showing Rockford to be not as successful as it could be, and the hope was that then you can bring the whole community up that way.
So a lot of those sort of those root causes that we often see that predate gun violence or might be predictors of gun violence there. So what are the things you're hearing? What are some of the concerns that you're hearing from the folks living in that neighborhood there when it comes to gun violence or other challenges?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that you hear is just kind of the acceptance that this is the status quo of what happens in neighborhoods like this. And that comes from the citizens that, you know, for a while it came from the police force, but, you know, the Rockford police are really changing the way they're policing in the communities. There's two community service officers working out of the home that the United Way purchased and runs. You know, myself and two community service officers are in charge of that. So, you know, I think that's the main thing, is that these, you know, shootings or gun violence happens and it's just kind of the way it is. And I think that's the concern, that there's not enough outrage and there's not enough people trying to change that. And I think it takes kind of everybody to change that paradigm a little bit.
And we'll talk a little bit later here in the hour as well about, you know, just the long-term impact of, you know, that doesn't just come from nowhere. There is a trauma that grows, you know, within any community when they're faced repeatedly with issues like violence or joblessness or whatever it might be, that kind of adds up over time. You know, so there you mentioned kind of the house that you're working out of there with the United Way. You know, what are you doing there? You know, and how is it helping to address these issues around gun violence?
So one of the things we do, myself, with the Rockford Police Department, we try to do programming that reaches out to, you know, the kids in the neighborhood. You know, most of the program we do, we're looking, you know, 10 to 14, 10 to 15-year-old, you know, kids to come out, especially during the summer and whenever there's breaks in school, you know, to try to give them something productive to do. Inside of that programming, we try to teach some type of skills. We just had a bike repair shop where we were trying to teach, you know, kind of mechanical skills and also some ownership over property. They got a bike at the end of that. But the bigger piece to that is we're beginning to try to use that programming as a lever to try to keep some of these young people out of the justice system, you know, initially. So you have a program, you promise the program, and you follow through. And in your interactions, my interactions with the citizens and the police interaction with the citizens, you're able to use that as a lever to entice them to stay out of trouble or to stay on task or, you know, to remain responsible.
Yeah, with some of that support. Are you seeing some signs? I know this is a fairly new program, last couple of years. Are you seeing signs that this is making a difference? Are you hearing from community members that that the work is making a difference there?
I think you feel it, right? I think the neighborhood is opening up to this, you know, this new neighbor, which we're just a neighbor and we're trying to be a productive one. We're trying to be vigilant and you know, we're trying to listen and be productive in the way we, you know, interact. I wish I could tell you that somebody's come up to me and said that the house has changed their lives, but I think it's a slow moving thing. I think, you know, we just are there, we're listening, and we're going to continue to grow. I know that, you know, the statistics show that the criminal offenses around the houses have gone down over the last 2 years, which is something we're very happy with.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a lot of work to do.
Well, Grant, thank you very much for the time. Grant Schubert, Neighborhood Impact Manager, United Way of Rock River Valley. We'll continue to talk about the work that's going on there and other areas around around Rockford. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joining us now is Paul Logley, President and CEO of United Way of Rock River Valley. Also, Dr. Sandra Martell, Public Health Administrator of the Winnebago County Health Department. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thank you for addressing this important issue.
No, of course, and it is important. We've been hearing from different communities around the state, you know, all summer about some of the different models, and you obviously have one there in Rockford. And Paul, let me start with you. I mean, I want to ask, you know, more about that program Grant described, but let's just step back for a moment. You know, there was a report not too long ago, I think it was early this year, that 2016, so a year ago, was one of the worst for Rockford in terms of gun violence in a number of years. What can you tell us about gun violence in the Rockford area, you know, especially over the past couple of years here?
Well, my background before I became president CEO of United Way was I was the elected prosecutor in Winnebago County for 21 years, the state's attorney. So I'm
you've
very
seen this
familiar.
Issue up close for a long time.
Oh, I've seen it up close. And what I can tell you is that shootings, homicides are unpredictable. They, in many cases, make no sense whatsoever. And what we're seeing is a pattern of gun violence, and I've been out of the state's attorney's office for about 10 years now, but what we're seeing that is really disturbing is that the violence is being perpetrated by younger offenders. It is not unusual now to arrest a 14, 15, 16-year-old for homicide.
So young teens.
Young teens, and then just carried it up until they're, you know, in their 30s, and then after they're in their 40s, they're not the biggest, toughest person on the block anymore, and that tends to drop off. But we used to say 20 to 40. Well, now we're saying 14 to 40, and that's really disturbing. Obviously, somebody's going to use a gun and kill somebody who has no judgment, but now the judgment is even worse, and we see in Rockford what you see in Chicago, which is shootings occurring in parts of the city that we never saw them before.
And, you know, we had talked with Jim Lewis, former U.S. attorney for Illinois, a couple of weeks back, and he talked about sort of flipping the model from one of, you know, reacting and being more reactive in terms of both communities and law enforcement, but also and then shifting towards more of a model of prevention. And that's kind of what I heard Grant describe there with what's called this Strong Neighborhood Houses initiative there. Can you kind of
that's
describe
correct.
That a little bit and what sort of the goals are of those houses?
Sure. Our program is modeled after a program we saw in Racine, Wisconsin. A group of city leaders and volunteers went up to Racine about 2-3 years ago. They've got 7 of these houses. They call them cop houses, citizen-oriented policing or community-oriented policing. Our neighborhood residents said, don't call them cop houses.
Mm-hmm.
So we call them strong neighborhood houses. And they provide an office for police officers. So instead of going to the station or riding around in their squad car, they can go to that house. And we have it set up with an office. We have conference rooms. We have a place for neighborhood associations to meet. The local library donated a very large bookshelf. We got books in there for adults and kids. We tell the kids, stop by any time. Take a book. They're not checking them out. Just take them. Take them home. We wanted to be a friendly place. We've always got a cup of coffee going. The United Way was asked to develop the house here in Rockford. Unlike Racine, which was developed by the police department, we were asked to develop it because we could do it probably less expensively and faster.
What you describe, even in the name of it, not calling the cops houses or whatever, but it trust must come into play too.
Absolutely. Trust is to me, the leading thing. We've got to build that trust between the police and the citizens. One police officer that I spoke with said that, you know, he had been working in this neighborhood for years. He said, I'd come to a call, get out of my squad, walk up to the porch, do whatever I had to do, and leave. He said, I never got to know the people. The kids never got to know me. He said, now that I've been in the house for 6 months, I know the kids by name. I get out of the car, and they run over to see me, and they know my name. Now, that's how we start building trust, or maybe in some cases rebuilding trust,
yeah.
Starting with the children and with the officers on the street.
And not, you know, not trying to come in and say that you have all the solutions or are going to fix everything, but that you are a part of the community. You actually have a house there. You're a neighbor in that community and are offering support and services to the community there. I want to bring Dr. Martel into the conversation. I mentioned earlier when we were talking with Grant about some of the things we've heard and talked about in the previous months here about, you know, what some of these communities face all across our state and how trauma can play a role in this. And I know there's things that you've been looking at as well. You know, you've got issues, hunger, you know, living with an abuser, poverty, not being able to find a job. These are all issues that have kind of been tied to gun violence. You know, and seeing it through that lens can kind of provide a different way of addressing it. As someone looking at this from a public health perspective, what are some of the factors in the Rockford area that you see, you know, contributing to gun violence and some of the ways to confront it?
Well, I think, interestingly enough, as all of this has been going on in the past, if you were to ask the health department, what are the health priorities your community is working on? And you'd get standard things like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity. This last go-around in what's called the I-Plan, where we put out the priorities to the community, we look at the data from all of our different data points, and we looked at, and what came back were three priorities the community said we needed to work on. One was maternal and child health with an emphasis on early intervention. Mental health / behavioral health, and we're not talking about mental illness, we're talking about positive social coping, and violence. And those three became, when you look at the risk factors identified by the Centers for Disease Control and the protective factors, those are all very much linked into some of this, what we call the social determinants of health. So when you look at where, like, the United Way is focused on addressing it, they're really looking at from that community perspective. What kinds of opportunities, engagement, that social participation do we need? We have many organizations. When we began to develop the plans, we really formed and coalesced what's called the Youth Violence Reduction Work Group. And it brings in a variety of community partners. And we are organized using the model of collective impact, meaning we all come with different expertise, different skill sets,
different relationships and different, backgrounds.
Right, resources. But we are all working toward the same goal, to reduce youth violence. So from a perspective of the, you know, you've heard the United Way perspective in their neighborhood homes. We have, you know, the police department has been represented in that area as well. We have a very strong community-based organization called Youth Services Network that provides servicing in the schools, the Boys and Girls Club, the YMCA, the health department, the Early Childhood Learning Council, and really began to start focusing. They started looking at it as well and began to look at that concept of the ACEs, or the adverse childhood event, and the early exposure to trauma, including violence in the home. So often when you look at those risk factors, you look at them from the individual risk factors, which you look at them from peer and social, and you look at them from that community perspective. And what we began to see is that, similar to other communities experiencing, we have a whole population where the exposure to trauma in this early forms of family violence are one of the predicting factors. And how do we address that and mitigate that early in the process so that we're not seeing them, as Paul pointed out, as a 14-year-old committing a homicide with a gun?
Right. And this is a relatively recent development, is a shift, at least as we're hearing about it across the state here, to kind of look at that question, that issue of trauma, and start to focus attention in that way. One thing I wanted to ask you about here is, you know, you talked about resources. You know, and we know that, especially in Illinois right now with the budget situation and everything else, resources are limited. So how are you there from a public health department? You know, how are you addressing, with the public health department, I should say, addressing limited resources and focusing those efforts in the best way you can?
Well, and I think that's where the collective impact model gives us a framework, which is, how do you all strategize and use your resources to the best efficiency possible to address that, that we're marching toward the same goal and end result of reducing violence. So for instance, in our programming, we're going to be administering the ACE assessment. Now, did that require a lot more? Yes, it requires training. It requires individuals for us to go through the process to put time into our schedules to be able to do that in terms of client encounters and either our WIC, our Women, Infant, Children Supplemental Nutrition, or our clinical services, as well as other organizations like Head Start. So again, oftentimes, yes, it's very difficult to find a big lump sum of fund, but often, and I'm not saying we have adequate funding, and I don't want to be misinterpreted in any way, shape, or form. We can always use additional.
More resources, sure.
But we can leverage our resources. We've said this is a major priority for us, and we are putting our major effort toward it.
All right. Well, talking right now with us, Dr. Sandra Martell, Public Health Administrator, Winnebago County Health District, up in Northern Illinois, the Rockford area there. Also, Paul Logley, President and CEO of the United Way of Rock River Valley. I'd like to, a couple more questions for each of you, if you can hang on here. We're coming up just on a little bit of a break here. But, you know, we've been talking all summer here about the issue of gun violence and some of the newer approaches that different communities are taking in different ways to approach it from more of a preventive question is what we've been talking about here, as opposed to reacting to violence from a law enforcement perspective after the fact. Stay with us. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, in for Nyla Boodoo today. We're talking about the issue of gun violence and what communities all across Illinois are doing to confront that issue in some new ways, some new thinking that comes into that. Talking with Dr. Sandra Martell, Public Health Administrator, Winnebago County Health District up in the Rockford area. Also, Paul Logley, President and CEO, United Way of Rock River Valley. Paul, just to come back to you here for a minute, we're talking about the houses. That are the strong neighborhood houses that are in some of the communities that you've been working on. You know, and one thing that I was wondering about as I heard Dr. Martell there talking and bringing together resources and bringing the right people into the room at the right time, how do you make sure that there are people in that room who come from the communities that are most affected by the gun violence in those areas?
Well, first off, the houses have meeting space, and we encourage the neighborhood association to come in and meet in the house. And so that's the first and that's one of the ways we get the grassroots in there. Before we open up those houses, our two neighborhood impact managers spent almost a year out listening, going door to door, going to schools, going to neighborhood associations. We did a lot of listening. We're not doing something that the neighbors didn't ask for. We feel very strongly that they control this. For instance, we've got a house next to our strong neighborhood house that's been in disrepair and is probably going to be getting torn down. It's been condemned. It's going to open up some green space. We're not going to decide what goes there. We're going to talk to the neighbors and say, what do you want there? Do you want green space? Do you want a basketball court? Do you want a community garden? We are very much there not to do something to them. We're there to help them take control of the situation.
So you're listening, so you're connecting to the resources that Dr. Martel was talking about and playing
absolutely
the support role like that. You know, Paul, we reached out to the city of Rockford, and unfortunately, just in the timeline, they wanted to come on, but nobody was available at the time to join us on the show. I mean, what can you kind of tell us, you know, from your perspective at least, you know, what have you been hearing from the mayor's office, law enforcement there in the community on this issue? Do they seem to be taking the right approach?
Well, I would say that we went through a change in administration about a year ago, and I say that the department has become very responsive. There are probably a few more officers on the street. They've reassigned people. They've gone to geographic policing. I think we all realize that we can't cuff and stuff our way out of this problem, that we've got to start at the earliest opportunities to build trust with the citizens. We need the kids to trust us. We need the adults to trust the police to know that they're valuable witnesses. My hope is someday we're going to have possibly a crime scene, and the guys from downtown come down there and work the crime scene, and the next day the neighbors start lining up at the Strong neighborhood house to talk to the officer there because they know him and they want to get the information to him. That's what we saw in Racine. That's what I would like to see in Rockford, and I think that's what the police want to see as well.
You know, I think, Dr. Martel, just to give you kind of the last word here, you know, I know you work for all of Winnebago County, but for our listeners in other parts of the state here, you know, what do you want folks to take away who are listening to the show right now about Rockford from this conversation?
Well, I think that what I really think the most important is, you know, you've got many boots on the ground addressing this issue from a real, that this is a priority for our community, and we are investing, we call it a family as infrastructure. We may have great physical infrastructures and community assets and attributes, but if we do not invest in the family as the community defines it, we are going to continue to not be able to address safety issues, and ultimately we'll have poor health outcomes. So I think the takeaway is that we cannot address these conditions in isolation. So, you know, Strong neighborhood homes are addressing it from multiple issues. We have to address the other contributing factors of the social determinants of violence, things like low educational attainment, lack of opportunity in employment, poverty, isolated housing, and Paul talks about, you know, one of our big areas in the health department is housing and making sure that it's safe, addressing things like lead exposures early in childhood so that we begin to address these factors earlier in the process to support the family and really helping to develop every member of that family to their fullest potential so that violence is not a standard of behavior.
And focusing on it from a community perspective, like you said. That's Dr. Sandra Martel, Public Health Administrator, Winnebago County Health District. Also, Paul Logley, President and CEO of United Way of Rock River Valley. Thank you both. A lot more we could talk about, but I appreciate your time today.
Glad to be with you. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, and sitting in for Nyla Boodoo here today. You know, even when they're able to reach out for help, victims of domestic violence face a daunting road. This is an experience that Sarah knows firsthand. I will say that we're using a pseudonym for her protection, for her safety. She went through this whole process not long ago and is joining us to share what her experience was like. Sarah, welcome to The 21st, and thank you for sharing your story with our listeners.
Thank you.
Now, I know that you were, you're very welcome. You know, what, you were a former client of a group called Between Friends, which helps people who are victims of domestic violence sort of navigate this path, but it's a complicated path. What made you decide to walk into the courtroom the day you decided to seek an order of protection?
Well, it's a very complicated path. I was a victim of abuse, and I didn't know where to go or what to do. And I went into the courthouse, and they led me to Between Friends, who just was there to support me and let me know the steps and how to go about everything. They helped me with an order of protection, and they actually stood with me when I had to go up before the judge. And without them, I would not have known what to do.
And well, I mean, I can imagine, just even coming forward to make that first step to say, yes, I need this order of protection, to go that far can be daunting. And then to walk into the courthouse, had that group not been there, had Between Friends not been there, what would that process be like for somebody who doesn't have that resource?
Do you know what? I don't know if I could have done it without them, to be honest. They're just incredible at how they guide you and how they take you through each step to learn how to do it, because it's just so mind-boggling when you go in there by yourself. You just don't know where to turn and where to go.
And there's paperwork. I mean, I just imagine mounds of paperwork and...
Mounds of paperwork, and you're so distraught from what you have been through that your mind, they just help. They just guide you through every single step. Like I said, I don't know if I could have done it without them.
Well,
they're just an incredible group that helps you through the paperwork and, like I said, stands by your side in the courtroom.
And without them, you would be standing in that courtroom. You would be talking about your experience in front of a judge, in front of a courtroom, describing very intimate details with no support?
With no support, exactly. Oh. They were my strength. They really, truly helped me throughout the entire process. Had I not found them, I don't know if I could have done it by myself.
Yeah, if you even couldn't have seen that through. And then at one point, I mean, if I understand right, in the process, not only do you go before a judge, but you also have to stand in that same courtroom and tell that same story in front of your abuser.
Exactly. And it is a very scary process. And with them here, they just give you the support and the confidence to go through with it.
What advice would you give to someone who might be right now in the position that you were in back then?
I would say call between friends, because they will guide you and they will help you. And you will know what to do instead of continuously being abused, which is just an awful way to live. No one should ever be abused mentally or physically.
Yeah, Sarah, how are you doing now?
Now I'm doing great. I actually am very confident now. I mean, because when you're abused, it takes your whole confidence away. And when you get out of that horrible situation, you gain your confidence back and know that you can do it.
Well, I really appreciate your time today. I think there are a lot of people who you helped today by sharing this story, and I appreciate you taking the time and talking to us.
I hope so. I hope so, because no one should ever stay in an abusive relationship. You don't deserve it.
You don't deserve it. I should mention that if you are out there, you're somebody you know might need help, the number for the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E. We'll tweet that out. I have it available on our website as well. Sarah, thank you again. I had mentioned a partnership that was formed to help Sarah, folks like her. She described through this process. It's in the Chicagoland area, and I'm joined now by three of the people who are helping to make all that happen. Brenda Torrey is a senior court advocate for the nonprofit Between Friends, which we just heard about. Kate Shank is the interim executive director of the Legal Assistance Foundation in Chicago. And Annie Helms, counsel and director of U.S. pro bono programs at the Chicago offices of law firm DLA Piper. All three of you, thank you. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Annie, you know, that process that we heard Sarah describe there at the start, it sounds awful. I mean, it's often hard enough to come forward in cases of domestic violence, but can you kind of take us a little bit inside that process then from the legal perspective? What has to happen for somebody to get an order of protection?
Sure. It's one of those processes that seems straightforward until you get involved in it, and then it's really not. A person has to take the step to decide that they want to leave an abusive relationship. They need to walk into a courthouse by themselves. They need to fill out confusing paperwork, and I will tell you that paperwork is even confusing for lawyers when we train them. And then they need to go and stand up in front of a judge and tell some of the most personal and private details of their life in order to get this protective order to help them get out. And it's often the first step that they take when leaving an abusive relationship.
Yeah. And when is there, I mean, she described, you know, without having the support there from the volunteers that you work with, you know, she's not sure she could have gone through this. Is there any sort of a guarantee of a lawyer? Is there the equivalent of a public defender for somebody going through this?
No, I mean, I think most people here on television, if you can't afford a lawyer, one will be provided for you. But that's really only if you're facing criminal charges. If you are facing the loss of your home through an eviction or foreclosure or if you're a domestic violence survivor, or there are many other situations where people have threats to their safety and security. And if they can't afford a lawyer, they just have to figure it out on their own.
Just figure it out on their own. Brenda, I mean, that comes to you then, you know, Brenda Torrey with Between Friends, you know, the program, we heard Sarah talk just briefly about it. Can you sort of explain that program? We've got a group partnership, group of roughly 30 corporate lawyers, volunteers, help desk there through the agency. What's the primary goal? How does it work?
Sure. So at the Rolling Meadows Courthouse, it's myself and one other full-time advocate who comes, holds an office here 5 days a week, and one volunteer advocate of Between Friends who comes twice a week. So the situation we find ourselves in is that there are two afternoons every week that the advocates are in the courtrooms assisting our clients who are here asking for their permanent two-year order. And so that means that our office is closed. So any petitioners who are seeking help are left alone. And the judge here at this courthouse, at one of our stakeholders meetings, brought it up. Like, he sees that there's a difference in paperwork. Petitions aren't being filled out correctly. People are lost and need some guidance. And it's a huge safety issue for many people who are walking through the door. So we are trying to brainstorm ideas. How can we get additional help to cover the time frames when the Between Friends advocates are not available? And then that's where Legal Assistance Foundation, or LAF, came into play and ultimately got in contact with DLA Piper. So at currently, they're volunteering every other Tuesday afternoon, and they're also providing coverage one full day on a Thursday in which the advocates need to go to the main office for staff meeting.
And you mentioned
so that
it.
Way, go ahead.
No, sorry. I was just going to say you mentioned LAF, you know, Romano's Legal Assistance Foundation. That's Kate Schenck. That's you, your organization there. You know, somebody mentioned, I think it was Annie at the top, described, you know, sort of even some of the lawyers coming in have a hard time, you know, understanding some of the paperwork and the process involved here. Your group does train the lawyers, the attorneys who are doing some of this work. How does that work? What is a how do you train them quickly, I suppose, to build up that capacity?
Absolutely. Well, we have attorneys on staff who are experts in domestic violence and representing survivors in the wide variety of remedies that are available to them. And so we have done a series of three separate trainings in order to support and engage our volunteers to feel comfortable not only working at the desk, but to know that they are giving the appropriate advice and guidance to the survivors that are coming in. So we've done trainings at three of our different corporate partners out near the Rolling Meadows Courthouse that have been attended by 20 or so lawyers and other advocacy staff each time. They've been very successful. They've gone through sort of information about domestic violence that's essential for anyone who's working with a survivor to know in terms of perspective, as well as of course, the law, the forms, the remedies, and the procedures, what survivors have to go through in order to obtain the order of protection.
So again, that complicated process, even for attorneys. Brenda, just briefly, and we're coming up on a break, but you know, what have you heard from clients who've received legal assistance through the program there, through Between Friends, you know, about the difference that it's made for them?
You know, I think the important thing for a lot of these petitioners is that somebody believes them. Even in situations where the order of protection may not be granted, they still at least feel that their voice was heard, that they are not crazy, that what they're going through is very real. Usually it's having that support system and the empowerment to take that step, as this is a dangerous time. The decision to leave the abusive partner is not one to take lightly. It's something they should plan out. There's high risk of lethality in that, unfortunately. So having the proper guidance can really take them a long way, make them feel more empowered and hopefully a little less anxious.
Well, that's the voice there of Brenda Torrey, Senior Court Advocate for Between Friends, Kate Schenck, Interim Executive Director of LAF, also talking with Annie Helms, Counsel and Director of U.S. Pro Bono Programs at the law firm DLA Piper, their Chicago office there. We are talking about this partnership, this novel program in the Chicagoland area, Between Friends involved in it, and some of these other groups to help victims of domestic abuse to be able to navigate that process, to take that first step to get an order of protection. against their abuser. And again, I'll just give out this phone number again, and we'll continue this conversation in just a moment. But if you, someone you know, needs help, again, that number for the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E. Also, of course, we'll tweet that out if you follow us at 21st Show. I have it available on our website as well. Stay with us. Lots more still to come. You are listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, in for Nyla Boodoo. I'm talking today about a program to help victims of domestic violence, particularly in the Chicago area there, to navigate the process of getting that first step, that protective order against their abuser. Talking with Annie Helms, Counsel and Director of U.S. Pro Bono Programs at the law firm DLA Piper, Brenda Torrey, Senior Court Advocate for Between Friends, and Kate Shank, Interim Executive Director of LAF, formerly known as the Legal Assistance Foundation in Metropolitan Chicago. Kate, just a couple of minutes left here, but is this a model that you've been describing, and the help and what we heard from Sarah earlier about how much help and support, and that she could not have done this without this program? Can this model be expanded to other communities?
It most definitely can. So what we saw is, like Brenda described, we saw a need. And then we also recognized that there were volunteers who were able and interested to help meet that need. So even when there isn't necessarily the paid staff from Between Friends or the paid staff from LAF that are able to be on site, there are volunteers that have the abilities and have the desire to step in and make a difference in their community. And it's just the factor of figuring out how to connect with those volunteers and let them know what the needs are, and then providing the training and the ongoing support that's necessary so that they can be engaged in an area that they may not necessarily have previous experience in.
Yeah, so just kind of connecting those different resources throughout the community and bringing them together, you know, in the right way. It just needs maybe one spark to make that happen. Brenda, you know, what, as we kind of wrap up here, I mean, what do you want victims of domestic violence to know about seeking help and about the resources available to them?
I would say most importantly, you're not alone, and there is help out there. There are many ways to connect. At Between Friends, our 24-hour hotline is 1-800-603-HELP. And if there's a need that we ourselves cannot fulfill for you, we provide referrals. We connect you to other domestic violence agencies or other support services, anything that's closer to home. There is help out there, and the grass is greener on the other side. Things get better. They may take time, but you don't deserve to be abused.
Don't deserve to be abused. Can you give that number one more time?
Sure. Our 24-hour hotline is 1-800-603-HELP, H-E-L-P.
H-E-L-P. All right. Brenda Torrey, Senior Court Advocate for Between Friends, also talking with Kate Shank, Interim Executive Director of LAF, and Annie Helms, Counsel and Director of U.S. Pro Bono Programs at the law firm DLA Piper, about this innovative program in Chicago. It's helping a lot of people. Thank you all very much for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
And you're listening to The 21st. A couple of years ago, a man in Iowa was convicted for harassing a neighbor. The jury in the case was all white. The man, Kelvin Plain Sr., was black. While everyone's promised a fair trial under Iowa law at the time, that disparity would likely not be enough to appeal his conviction, at least not until now. The Iowa Supreme Court ruled last month that defendants of color are now able to challenge all white juries. That gives defendants in Iowa at least a better chance of defending themselves from discrimination, from bias in the jury system. The ruling could have far-reaching effects beyond Iowa. With me to talk now about how courts do or do not consider race and ethnicity when it comes to juries and what this ruling could mean, including here in Illinois, is Suja Thomas, professor of law at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She focuses on jury trial rights. Wrote the book, The Missing American Jury. Professor Thomas, thanks for coming in. Welcome to The 21st.
Thank you very much.
So this ruling itself, and I know that we're in Illinois, this was in Iowa, it's a state away, but from your perspective, how significant is this ruling?
I think the ruling is very important. Of course, you know, in Iowa, it's incredibly important. It made it more likely that a person accused of a crime will have a jury that includes at least one juror of his race. And just a couple of points about the case itself and the facts mm-hmm. there. Really interesting facts. As you said, there were neighbors and there was a dispute at night. One of the neighbors, the black neighbor, was sweeping, and the other neighbor came out, and there was some type of dispute between them, possibly some throwing of things and threats between the two. And ultimately, the police were called, and the person who was black was accused and charged with harassment. And an all-white jury convicted him of harassment. And that all-white jury came from a pool of people, which included only one African-American.
And there were 56, if I remember right. Yes. One of that group was African-American.
Right. And that's only 1.8% of that group. But Black Hawk County, where this case occurred, actually has 8.9% African Americans. And so the black defendant said, you know, this isn't fair. This violates my Sixth Amendment right to an impartial jury. And the United States Supreme Court has said that there should be a fair cross-section of the community, and it's supposed to be...
Well, there's a process, right? I mean, there is a test, isn't there? And there was in this case. Yeah. I mean, but what does that look like? What was the test, I guess, and how has it changed now?
Yeah, so the test, you know, gets into numbers, and so the test uses that 8.9%, and it subtracts the 1.8% that was actually in the pool, and then it comes up with that 7.1%, right? Mm. And they say then that if it's over or if it's over 10%, yeah, that's a problem. You know, whenever you have your populations of under 10% in a community, which Iowa has a lot of those, then those people are out of luck, even if there are zero people on the jury. And so this decision is very important because it says we shouldn't just use that test. We should use other tests and have a more flexible test.
So is it, and this gets into the weeds a little bit, I suppose, but from what you're saying there, is it only all white juries that could pose a problem under these tests, or does the new test demand even more equity than that?
So, you know, in a lot of communities where you have small numbers of or percentages of minority groups, you know, it just depending on what the percentage is. And these okay. different tests are going to question, you know, whether or not it's an appropriate percentage. And the real issue here is that what pool of people from which the state itself was actually picking those jurors to get to that jury pool that only included 1.8% African-American when the whole community had 8.9%.
Right. And so... And then if you can bounce a juror for any reason in the early process, that can take that out right away.
Exactly, exactly. Right. So this can be problematic, and luckily Iowa is doing something about that.
You know, it just makes me think a little bit bigger picture here. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, the promise of a fair trial, you know, often includes a concept of being judged by a jury of your peers, you know, right? So you talked about some of these states like Iowa and others where the percentage of the non-white population can be really small, especially in some communities. That's true even here in Illinois in some cases. So if I'm a person of color and I live in one of those communities, you know, where that the people who look like me make up a tiny fraction of the population and the jury pool, then how does this play out for me in the courtroom? I mean, what's at stake in this conversation?
So, you know, what's at stake is perceptions as well as possibly fairness. And, you know, one of the things that the Iowa Supreme Court did is they pointed out a Duke study, which showed that where you actually have an all-white jury, African-Americans are actually more likely to be convicted than white defendants. So the percentage is 81% for African-Americans versus 66% for white defendants. But then if you change that jury pool and the jury pool includes at least one African-American, the conviction rates of whites and blacks then become virtually the same. So it really matters.
So just one person on that jury can make that big of a difference.
And it's actually just the jury pool. It's actually not
really
the jury. So they were actually studying jury pools. And so, you know, even when you have a significant set of people on the in the jury pool, that doesn't even guarantee that you get them on the jury. So we're talking about, in this case, the jury pool, and there are even problems with respect to, you know, once you start picking, like you said before, once you start picking from that jury pool.
Right. You know, there is, you mentioned the research from Duke. I mean, there's all sorts of research that shows that, you know, the effects of implicit, unconscious, conscious bias and decision-making in different ways. You know, how does Iowa compare to states like Illinois, I guess, when it comes to jury selection, the rules around that process? Do you know that?
Sure. And so one of the things that I did is I found a case from many years ago where an Illinois appellate court actually had worse facts than in the Iowa case. And they said this was okay under the Sixth Amendment, that this was okay.
And do states have their own rules then? Is that
So each state, right? So each state Supreme Court and then the appellate courts determine their rule, but they're guided by the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court hasn't decided this question. So Michigan tried to, in 2010, tried to get the United States Supreme Court to decide in favor of the way that the trial court in Iowa did, but they weren't, the Supreme Court decided not to decide the issue. So in the future, I would imagine the Supreme Court's going to decide how all of these, how juries should be picked more specifically.
And then Illinois, I mean, how does Iowa compare to Illinois then right now?
Sure. So because of that appellate court decision and what the Illinois Supreme Court has done, it hasn't actually said specifically, you know, that these other tests apply. And so you could get in a circumstance like some years ago where that appellate court said that this was okay, something that was worse than what happened in Iowa. At the same time, though, I will say that Illinois has a great effort that's being put forth right now that started a few months ago. A few judges came together. Judge Khoury was the leader of this. And in five counties now, including Peoria, they're actually making an effort to actually have the jury pool percentage equal the percentage of the minority group in the population.
Which makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's just this incredibly excellent effort that Illinois is going to make, and I hope other states will follow Illinois.
You know, and thinking about this the decision, and we're talking with Professor Suja Thomas about a case out of Iowa where the Supreme Court ruled that an all-white jury effectively took away part of the fairness of a black man's trial. You know, this is what we discussed earlier. Given the scope, you know, of the problem in the long history, I mean, this is not happening in a vacuum. There's a long history in the country, in the criminal justice system in particular, about racial discrimination and bias for ethnic reasons. Now, given that scope in the long history, I mean, do you think this ruling goes far enough in Iowa?
I think the ruling goes as far as it could with respect to that issue. There were other issues in the case that were interesting, including whether or not there should have been an instruction specifically that race shouldn't have been considered.
Because there was not in this case.
Well, the instruction, they had asked for the instruction, and then the instruction was not given. And the Iowa Supreme Court said that it wasn't required, but there was a discussion among the judges as to whether or not it should be. Now, this is a difficult question, and there's a judge out in Iowa named Mark Bennett. He's a federal judge, and he actually advocates an instruction about implicit bias, what you referred to earlier, and not particularly race just itself, but about implicit bias and how we're all subject to that and that jurors should be aware of that. And that may be the best answer right now while studies occur as to whether or not instruction about race itself would actually be effective.
So you think it might, but there has not been a research, it sounds like, to show that definitively?
Exactly. I'm not sure, right? I'm not the expert on that, and the studies have to happen. And in fact, lots of jurisdictions haven't required this type of instruction.
So, you know, could you see this ruling? And it sounds like it's state by state and it's complicated and it even hasn't been completely ironed out in Illinois. But what would it take? And could you see this ruling expanding to other states?
So I think any time a ruling like this comes out by a state Supreme Court, other courts are going to pay attention. And I think on top of that, we definitely have each of these places across the country are certainly aware that the jury pool, when it doesn't represent the person who's actually on trial and the jury itself, obviously, when it doesn't represent, that doesn't seem fair to the person who is actually the criminal defendant. And then as a result, you possibly also may have, you know, problems with that jury and how they actually convict, which we've already talked about the statistics. So I think that everyone's going to be looking at this decision. And I think ultimately, as I said before, I think the Supreme Court will be weighing in on this.
Yeah, at some point. Well, Suja Thomas, an interesting conversation here, the case again out of Iowa, but potentially with ramifications in Illinois and in other states. A professor of law at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, focusing on jury trial rights, author of The Missing American Jury. Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming in and talking to us today.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have here for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st, also available on iTunes, on Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find there. Just tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us, phone, email, social media, it's all on our website, 21stshow.org. Follow us also on Twitter. Search for The 21st Show. We live tweet during the show, more analysis, background about many of the topics that we're talking about. Also on Facebook, just search for The 21st to like us there. You can comment on what we're working on, post questions or comments you might want to ask us on the air. We are produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecelio, Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Thanks to Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music you're hearing right here. I'm Scott Cameron, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.